is Tracy with Spiritual Not Religious, and
this is Josh, also here.
Josh. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Tracy.
How are you?
Feeling good. Enjoying my coffee.
I'm having coffee too.
Excellent.
I'm having French press. What kind are you having?
Let's have a cheers noise.
Okay. Nice. I'm having French press. What kind are you having?
Drip coffee.
Oh.
You know, I like drips so much that I took a picture of the drips on the edge of my coffee mug and posted it to Instagram. That's how I feel about drip things.
Huh, interesting. Yeah, I've noticed your Instagram has a lot of things that are like the underbelly of the mundane that you are elevating to an art. Like I saw on something on your Instagram once, which was a sink full of dirty dishes.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do a whole series on irrigation ditches.
Mm-hmm.
I get it.
Yes.
Sir.
Yes.
I get it.
How can you possibly get that?
Do you want to know? Or are you, is that rhetorical?
We got to get back into
the game. Oh, we got to get into the game.
This was our introductory set of remarks here.
Dude, we haven't remarked enough. Are you just like...
Down to business.
Down to business?
You told me about the last podcast that we were in a, like, I'm making a gesture with my hands being too big.
We're thinking about doing a YouTube channel, by the way. So that you guys can see our vivid and elaborate gestures that we both make a lot of them. Anyway, go ahead, sir.
Bodies in Space.
Space
was the title of the previous podcast. Mm-hmm. How do we feel about our bodies? I step on a scale sometimes and I see a number. And for some reason, I attach that number to my body and the need to change my behavior. Does anybody else relate to that process?
I don't even know what you're talking about, Josh.
Oh, yeah?
No, of course I do. Yeah, it is a thing. Okay, so certainly cave people were not doing that.
No, they had no scales.
Mm-hmm. And if they had scales, they would probably be weighing shells as a primitive form of currency.
Instead of rocks?
I just think rocks are so ubiquitous that they... Well, but shells can be pretty easy to come by, too. I think shells presumably were an early form of currency, were they not? Like puka shells or something?
Shells were the container of living bodies at one time that were discarded. Why do we cherish the shell and not that gooey mass that lived inside the shell?
Well, we do. People make stew out of it.
Hmm.
And they go, hey, and this is nice, too. So, yeah.
Okay. It's true. But it's
I see what you tried.
I tried. You weren't willing to riff with me. I feel like...
No, I'll riff all the day long.
I felt like an improv that was cut off there.
Oh, well, no. Saying they make stew out of it is still a yes and.
It is? Maybe I wanted yes and do this. And you said yes and other thing other than I wanted. You see, these are the intricacy things about improv that you know that I don't know. Teach me. Teach me a wise one.
Wow. Anybody who's good at improv just now just gave themselves a migraine roll in their eyes because I'm not very good at improv. Well, I'm kind of pretty good at it. As a pedestrian person who overvalues her own abilities, I would say I'm moderately good.
We have to value our abilities. We have to value mediocrity. That's why I take pictures of mundane things. You know, generally we value perfection a little bit more, grace, beauty, to the point where if we aren't held up to that standard, we might feel like ashamed of ourselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. See what you're trying there. Josh suggested that I have some ideas about the concept of shame that might even in some settings be controversial, but I doubt they're that controversial. I might be elevating them a bit in my own mind by even suggesting that. But I think they're different. They're definitely different than most people think of the concept of shame. Most people associate it with a conscience. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it is. I don't think it is an attribute of a conscience. But shame as almost like a an entity within the psyche tells you that it is a virtue, that it is an emblem of virtue. And I don't think it is. And as evidenced by the fact that it is the engine that drives a lot of very unhealthy behaviors.
And we see, though, in religions, occasionally shame almost being used as a kind of a tool for social organization. So it
Heck yeah. Not almost, for all the way. Heck yeah.
So that shame can sort of almost bring people together in a way.
Fascinating. Tell me what you mean by that. In what ways do you feel shame brings people together?
Well, if people share a certain sense of shame about a certain kind of moral transgression, and they have the ability to experience penitence in a similar way, that shame has almost elevated them to spiritual heights.
Is that what they believe to be true, you mean? Or is that actually it does?
That's me telling a story. I have no clue. You're the shame expert. I'm just like riffing on the whole shame thing here. I'm trying to like build shame into religion, and we tried to bring it into our squishy bodies that aren't quite perfect, trying to think that like it's what makes us good people because we're in touch with our shame and we do.
Well, let's look at perfection for a minute. You said it does tie in. I mean, the concept of shame is what tells us that we're supposed to be perfect. Okay. I'm going to spoiler alert on a bunch of this because I feel like one thing that really came through today when you and I were chatting.
Having a very intimate discussion.
We were in a bunch of hot water.
Yeah.
We were in some hot water. And we were having a discussion about a bunch of things. And the concept of shame, I'm not sure why we started out on the concept of shame, but I had a little bit of a glimmer of, I would say, a fresh insight about shame. Because one thing, I've been looking at shame as a feature of addiction and other, and as an engine that drives a lot of other dysfunctional behaviors for a while now in my practice and so forth. I see that, for instance, when people are processing issues and trauma and things like that, when they get to a certain root point in their reprocessing, they land in this big glob of shame. And very frequently, as evident, and my clear evidence that shame is not the same as a conscience is that the shame that really drives people is their shame, like the victims of abuse, for instance. The victims, people who were themselves victims of abuse, in one form or another, will very often hold a feeling of shame. And that, of course, doesn't make sense, because why would a person feel shame for something that someone else did? So that's, to me, if you feel, so that's not a conscience. A conscience is when I choose what I believe is the right thing to do for myself and others. Because it's the right thing to do for myself and others, I choose to not do the thing that's not right for myself and others because it's not right for myself and others. To me, that's a conscience. Shame doesn't, I'm in shame, I don't seem to be able to differentiate what's my responsibility versus what someone else's responsibility. So I'm saying I'm not good enough because someone else did something bad to me. So that's, to me, if you can follow all of that, that's the proof in the most simple way that shame is not the same as a conscience.
Would you say that all really good stuff, that powerful shame, like in an abuse situation, generally occurs when something harmful happens from a person that's very close to you, like an intimate person or something like that. And perhaps in those moments are the moments where our physical boundaries are the most permeable. It's almost if during those moments, you kind of feel so close that you might lose track of who's me and who's the other person. And that's why the violation is so powerful. And that's why maybe later on, when there isn't a sense of intimacy with that shame-inducing interaction, you blame yourself because it occurred in the moment where you were so close to another person that person hurt you in a way you felt like you were responsible for it, because in your vulnerability, you were almost overlapping with your sense of identity. And then later on, it's like, whoa, there's no intimacy. There's no closeness. Why am I still feeling pain? You know, so I'm trying to get back to the sense of embodiment. The moment of shame was where you were sharing a little bit of your consciousness and intimacy. And then it happens. And then later on, why is there this sense of responsibility? It wasn't me, but at the time, it kind of felt like it was you, because you were so intimate, so close, so vulnerable.
Right. Well, I would say the depth and the breadth and the intensity of the shame is directly correlated to how close the person was, which is why abuse by someone that you love or care about is always hard, or even that you're, or even that you feel like you should have been able to love or whatever, is so much more intense and intractable. But on the other side of it, I will say, like, once my house was robbed. When I was there, I slept, it was in the middle of the night, I was asleep. And I didn't even know it happened until my dog freaked out. You know, this was years and years ago. My dog freaked out. And then I was like, what the what? That's what woke me up. And then the people who had gotten in the house through an open window skedaddled. But okay.
You still felt violated.
I felt, well, yeah, sure I did. But the thing is that there was a point, and I'd had, and one of the things they stole was my laptop, and I had my laptop in my bedroom. And weirdly, one of the thoughts that came to my mind was, well, I shouldn't have left my laptop out. Like, I was taking response, which doesn't make any sense, right? Like, it was my laptop in my house, in my bedroom. But I was thinking, oh, well, it's my fault for not hiding my laptop. Of course, I quickly, because that doesn't make any sense, I was able to fairly quickly go, well, that doesn't make any sense. I shouldn't have to hide my belongings inside my home. So it's this sense of, in a sense, I felt I took responsibility for something that doesn't make sense when I was the victim of an assault on my property and also my space, because it was pretty spooky, because what woke me up was the intruder was in my bedroom when I was asleep, as evidenced by the fact that they took my laptop in my bedroom. But also what woke me up was my dog, where it was like, bark, bark, bark.
So how does that kind of shame, we're not, that's like bumping out away from that intimate person.
I was, I was saying, but it was, but I was able to get over it quickly.
So we got
because
real
it was
shame.
Minimal. It was minimal because the actual offense was not by a partner or by someone who I cared about. But then you go all the way over to here to where someone who's perhaps supposed to be taking care of you in some way, like whatever.
So this is good. We're kind of creating some categories of shame that might allow us to identify the varieties that are most problematic in our lives.
Well, I'm going to call it, rather than categories or varieties, I'm going to call it a spectrum of intensity.
Oh, a spectrum or a continuum. I, you know, the thing about spectrums is it's harder to compartmentalize the experiences of pain when you put it on a spectrum.
That's, and I don't think it really is compartmentalized.
Yeah.
No, I think it is a spectrum.
Yeah. I think it is too. I like compartmentalization because it facilitates analytical processes, but let's move away. I'm doing my thing where I bounce too much here. So coming back. I'm back. Hi, Tracy.
Hey, dude.
What's up?
Sup.
Yeah.
Sup.
High five.
High five. Okay. Okay. So yeah, I just think things are a spectrum. So if you have to put, and so I'm going to stay with fudge cookies. You know how I am. I just like you, I have the attention span of a squirrel.
Well, the spectrum thing is good because it keeps a sense of connection to all the areas. So even when the attention span goes somewhere else, the only reason it's pulled back because it is on a spectrum of connection to the awareness of the moment. I think that that attentional scattering is almost evidence of the presence of the continuum of attentional spectrum experience. I think of spectrums as connectors. I think of them as a variety of intimacy. You know, spectrums let us get closer. High vibrational kind of things, if we're looking at light, you know, tight. It's almost as if the wavelengths have an intimacy. You know, Anyway, I'm digressing also, but I'm trying to get back to the experience of intimacy a little bit, because okay. I think attention is a sense of separation. Sometimes people will use...
Attention is a sense of separation?
The absence of...
The absence of attention.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'll buy that.
I mean, what focuses our attention? Intense experiences a lot of times, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so our attention is hyper-focused during moments of trauma that allow the shame to be maintained usually, right?
Say it slower. You know what? You've distilled these ideas so that you can talk about them very quickly, and you're talking about big chunks of idea as quickly as you can, because to you, you're perceiving them as a chunk.
Mm-hmm.
But say them slower. Say the thing, speak more slowly if you're willing, because you're talking about some really good stuff, and even I'm having a hard time keeping track of it, and I don't want to miss anything, because you're saying some really juicy stuff.
In the moment when shame gets embedded into a person's identity, usually attention is hyper-focused on that, say, painful experience from an intimate person. So attention creates a sense of connection that makes us especially vulnerable. Dispersion of attention is almost a protective measure, the dissociation that we sometimes use to describe.
Right, sure, sure. So
that helps a bit. Good advice on the slowness.
Mm-hmm.
Did it help?
It did. Okay. Yeah, when something's too obvious to a person, like some things might already be obvious to you because you've thought about them lots and lots and lots, or your faculty for understanding things is already pretty well developed. So it's easy to forget all the steps in between. The best writing advice I ever got was back in college. I'd written a critique of the sexual imagery in the play, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Because there's just like rampant sexual imagery in the language in that. And so I did a paper on it. And the professor said, she gave me like an A-. And she said it was good, but that I needed to remember that I needed to explain. I couldn't just say, and then they said this, and just assume everybody's going to know that that was a sexual reference. I would have to explain why that was a sexual reference, or give a little bit more exposition on ideas. So she got what I was saying, but she said, you need to like explain more where the ideas come from. And it was almost like, I know that seems like the most obvious thing in the whole wide world, but it was like, just because I know what I'm talking about, doesn't mean anyone else, like, but the reason I know what I'm talking about is because I know I went through all the process of coming of formulating the idea.
Yeah.
And so I say a word and it means the whole idea. Yeah. But for most people, they didn't go that particular journey. So you think you're you know, quite brilliant mind. So you kind of are doing that too. And I ain't no schlub. Yeah.
Well, this truly, but I can't follow you
sometimes.
No, this truly goes back to a sense of shame, because a lot of times in shame, it has to do with things that are hidden, right?
Well, we hide them because we believe we need to, because we think they are shameful.
Like, I might hide some of my explanations when I'm talking fast, because maybe I'm a little ashamed of like not having thought them through really well, or that there's areas that I don't understand. Like, I have really cool ideas, and I might jump around a little bit because I happen to know that I've connected them, perhaps lacking good evidence.
So
it happens with people that are really intuitive, I think, solving math problems, you know?
Yeah.
They just go right to the answer and they've got it. They have all those faculties. But on some levels, and I think this is maybe why there's some insecurity among really smart people, is that they connect the dots without knowing why. And then they feel a sense of separation from other people who don't connect the dots. And this goes back to this idea of perfection. Like, some people are just beautiful and they were born beautiful, you know? And how'd they get there? What were the steps that they took to reach that perfection? I mean, a lot of other people are trying to take steps to look beautiful, But every step of the way, there's a little bit of shame in there because they aren't quite there yet.
Well, yeah, but what is beautiful? I mean, I know that sounds like a banal or almost like pseudo-intellectual question, but I don't mean it that way. I mean, like, why do we decide one thing is beautiful and something else isn't?
I think it's we're looking for a state of the absence of shame's grace. We're looking for a place of grace, and that's one of the motivations.
The absence of shame's grace.
The absence of shame's presence.
The absence of shame's present.
Is
well, I'll say a lot of people that are
shameless.
No, a lot of people who are conventionally beautiful by the standards of symmetry and, you know, whatever cultural and biological standards that we stew up in a big stew pot and decide what beauty is. I mean, that's really where those ideas come from to a great extent. Don't feel good. So it doesn't, so I've certainly met many very, very beautiful, conventionally beautiful people who were even, who were obsessed with never losing that because they realized it was the, it was what they were trading on. It was what they, it was the currency with which they were navigating the world.
Almost like white privilege.
Exactly. Like white privilege, beauty privilege. But you know, worse. I mean, white privilege is worse because it's more subliminal. But let's not go down there. We were talking. That was something we got into today. Was the idea of white privilege?
Well, this is really good because we have these, you know, a spectrum here of like an individual's person, like beauty privilege. That's like a very body centered thing. And then we have this larger macro scale thing of, you know, a whole race kind of having that advantage of their beauty, air quotes, you know?
Yeah, of which, right, exactly. Yeah.
And why aren't the people with privilege ashamed of what they've done with their privilege that they're not aware of?
And also, well, some of them are, but I'm arguing that the shame doesn't, this is part of my whole approach to shame.
Conscience versus.
Yeah, shame does not improve behavior. That's why now a conscience can and does. A developed, cultivated conscience will. But shame, okay, I mean, this is, and I've quoted this a zillion times to anybody who's, any of my clients or anybody who's going to be like, oh, we've heard this one before. This goes back to something that a mentor of mine back many, many, many years ago said to me when I was first beginning a meditation practice, a chanting practice back in the in my early 20s. And I had all these guilt feelings all the time if I would miss Gongyo, if I was would miss my practice, if I would miss my meditation practice, I'd be like, oh, I've lost all my benefit. I'm going to, right? And the young women's leader who was a, you know, in her probably about 30 and had practiced her whole life. And she goes, Tracy, no offense to the Catholics out there, but she goes, Tracy, were you raised Catholic? And I said, yeah. I was like, how did she know that? And she goes, you need to get guilt out of your life as soon as possible. And I said, but how can you even have a religion without guilt? And she said, Tracy, guilt is just an excuse not to change. And I was like, okay, that makes no sense whatsoever. And I'm telling more in the context of this podcast, because this podcast includes a little bit more of my personal story than I am going to ever have with like clients. So this is a little bit more, I usually just tell the guilt is an excuse not to change part of the story. But I was like, what the what? Like, that did not make any sense to me at all. And so I sat down and just chanted for like a couple hours trying to figure that one out. Because it did not make sense. Because I really felt like guilt was the thing that was keeping people from doing bad stuff. And so it was necessary. And, but then, so I'm chanting, like, what does that even mean? And all of a sudden, all of these images and experience of from my life story and my current and past and everything, it just came in front of my eyes. And I realized that whenever I did something that wasn't what I believed was the right thing to do, mm-hmm. I would feel guilt. Mm-hmm. And the guilt would be like this big, heavy weight in me that mm-hmm. would make me, would suck up my energy. And on some level, I would think, well, see, I'm not really that bad because look how bad I feel. I feel so guilty. So that mm-hmm. means I'm not really a bad person. Mm-hmm. So it would give me an excuse. And I would just go back and do the same behavior again later. Because it was an excuse not to change. And that was like so profound at the time. And I learned so much from that. And I realized that when I do something, what I call now, I call being out of my integrity, mm-hmm. which means that, like, let's say, like, I it is my desire to not be mean, mm-hmm. for instance, because I have a lot of reasons why I believe being mean is not a good idea for me and other people in the world. Now, does that mean I'm never mean? Yes, sometimes I am mean.
Yes.
You say that too knowingly, Jeff. Yeah. Have I ever been mean to you?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, we get that. I'm sorry. Oh my gosh. Have I really been mean to you?
Yes.
I'm sorry. You haven't told me about it.
We don't always tell each other when somebody's been mean to us.
Oh my gosh. Well, we should discuss it. We might need to edit this part out, but I'm so sorry. Will you tell me about it later or now if you want to, if it's not inappropriate?
I don't know. It's the kind of mean where it's a kind of hurt that doesn't like scar me. So a lot of things hurt that other people do that I just let go. Because I understand that they're humans and they probably don't realize like something hurts me. I pretty much, it's almost as if I have realized in life that people don't want to be mean, but sometimes they are mean. And if I notice that, sometimes I'll tell them and sometimes I won't.
I respect that. And it's your story, your narrative, and you get to decide whether or not to mm-hmm. share it. You
yeah.
own it.
Yeah.
But I would hope, and this is something, I mean, this isn't too out of school, because the shame that one feels when they have been called out for mm-hmm. having been mean, like I was just saying, I'm not mean, mm-hmm. but I am mean sometimes. And then the way you said, yes, I was like, oh, that sounded like a knowing mm-hmm. recognition of, yes, you can be mean. Mm-hmm. I don't think you've ever been mean to me. Mm. I don't think you have. My sensitivity for meanness isn't super acute either, mm-hmm. to be honest. Like, I think sometimes people do things that other people think are mean, and I'm like, oh, was that mean?
Yeah.
But I'm not saying I never uh-huh. feel like anyone's ever yeah. mean, but it takes a lot for me to get all the way there. Mm-hmm. But no, I would say I don't think you've ever been mean to me. Uh-huh. So the reason why I think this is actually juicy here uh-huh. is that this is the thing of shame, and that's in the context of like white privilege. Like the book, White Fragility, Why It's So Hard to Talk to White People About Racism. Read the book, my friends. It is such a good book. Oh my gosh. And it is a ass whooper too for like, oh, it's just like, it made me see some of my own BS. Mm-hmm. I have plenty more BS that I have not yet allowed myself mm-hmm. to see, mm-hmm. but I have a Charlie horse. That's why I'm moving my uh-huh. leg weird right now. I have a Charlie horse in the back of my thigh. But this is like the whole thing of how do you process that? Like, I think this is like, I could right now, if I felt shame, mm-hmm. then what would I do? I'd get defensive. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I was not, or whatever. Like da, 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 da. That would mm-hmm. be like, no, I wasn't. Well, I was never mean to you.
Yeah.
And that would be an expression of shame. That's how shame doesn't help us do better. Huh. Or the other one I could do is, oh my gosh, I'm such a bad person. Oh, mm-hmm. I'm so bad because I was blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then I've put the attention on me yeah. Yeah. where you have to be like, rescue me of like, oh, Tracy, you know, it's okay. But if I'm in a space of I'm not, I feel embarrassed or shame of like, I've been mean at some point, and I don't know what it was exactly. I kind of, I know one event that we had where I was, I can see where that was mean. Okay, so back from the break, and that was some, that we started in a spot in that last little bit about, we're talking about the capacity to be mean, and then we were processing about, I thought it was a great case study in how to navigate feelings of shame in a relationship, which is also tied to everything else that we're talking about. It's this thing of like, I could in that moment react those different ways, like deny it or act super dramatic as a way of trying to like distract from your experience in one way or another. And but if I can be in the middle without being driven by shame and say, wow, I'm sorry. Tell me about that. I, as a human, am capable of not being perfect. No, I'm not just capable of not being perfect. I'm incapable of being perfect because perfection doesn't exist in this dimension. Then we can actually process it. I can sincerely apologize, potentially make amends, get back into my integrity. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking about, I'm going back to what I feel is the intriguing part of this is the long-term containment. Because, you know, our discussion of like, because of our communication and relationship, we do have the ability to kind of talk it through, figure out what's going on. The somewhat more intriguing topic, though, outside of our personal conversation, is when the shame is like overwhelming, when it sort of takes over a person's behavior patterns, their identity on a social level, on an individual level. Social levels, like we're talking white privilege, it's like, I would say those people that broke into the White House, you could say like, they should be ashamed themselves. Don't they realize the transgressions that are taking place here? You know, all the harm that this is doing. So it's like a social level where we might almost say that, why hasn't their conscience kicked in to keep them from doing something so harmful? You know, how did they feel that that was okay? You know? So this is one example of where we might say someone should have their shame kick in as part of their conscience. So, but I am a little more interested in this, the shame that inhibits a person's developmental process is what I'm more interested in. Because the natural sense of growth and development in a human being that the shame like gums up, that's the kind of thing that I think is a more a fruitful discussion outside of our interpersonal process. I mean, it's nice to model it.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Well, do you feel, to me, the microcosm and the macrocosm are the same, right? And I know we've talked about that. You have the same perspective on that. So in a sense, but it's only in the microcosm that we can really, I think, come up with solutions. Because in the microcosm, we have each individual's will and choice. And there are collective will and choice. But I don't think societal macrocosmic things can't change without microcosmic action. So I think the interpersonal aspect of our interactions interpersonally, without going into like specific details in this context, but I think that is how people figure out how to have a different world is by figuring out how to behave differently in the immediacy of their close personal relationships.
This is pretty good stuff. It leads a little bit into why I have had struggles with contemplative practices for resolving or for emotional regulation. Because it is too interiorly focused, you know. It's not so interior in that you can develop a sense of connection with other people through an individual practice, but ultimately it's through the interactions that some clarity is developed. This is where separate consciousnesses interacting in the micro scale can yield insight-based changes that might not be possible through one's personal practice. So it's a way of sort of exposing oneself for the purpose of resolving shame when, because right, when you're only as like sick as your secrets, so there's almost an essential stripping that's required. And that's one of the things we can do in intimacy. We can get naked with each other, you know, and that getting naked on a social level, shame, man, you'll get put in a hospital if you're naked on a social level, won't you?
If you're literally naked. but I think, and that ties back to something that we alluded to last time, was at the end of our last episode, was talking, you know, about the idea of, because you brought up the idea of intimacy as being a topic that you wanted to look at. And I said, and looking at how intimacy, the word intimacy is often used as a euphemism for sex or sexuality, when in fact, they are not the same thing. In fact, you can have sex without any intimacy. Or you can, and you can have intimacy without any sex. You can have intimacy and sex concurrently, and they can be mutually enhancing for sure. But they also can, I mean, sex can get in the way of intimacy sometimes because it's so vulnerable. And if a person doesn't feel like vulnerability is safe, that's why people, some people disassociate in the context of sex as much as they do. There's a lot of reasons from that, trauma related wise and so forth. But it's like that it is so scary to be that close to the person that people will disassociate in the sense of just checking out.
Because they're worried about getting hurt? Or because they were hurt in the past?
Those would be some reasons.
Yeah, lots of stuff,
Those would be some of the reasons, But also because they might even have it from the perspective of, even we talked about societal things, the fact that they are not perfect physically. Like, oh, I'm not, I have to be physically perfect in order to be okay. This person's really seeing me now without all of the trickery.
And this is where the macrocosm is brought to a personal level, because recognition that there was a societal programming that made me sort of tending to be like self-conscious about myself and fearful of intimacy. It's kind of, it helps to have that awareness and then to bring it into the moment where like you and I could talk to each other in that moment of intimacy, and some awareness of social programming might help us develop into insight on how we on an individual level could take action for change to make our intimacy better or something like that.
You know?
So there's that. Because I think too, a lot of the systemic shame is created on a social level. Some of it is social level, and some of it is like hurt by an intimate person during a vulnerable place. These, this is a spectrum thing going on, right?
So I think shame is like, it's sort of like when I say it's like shame exists for everyone, and experiences and situations will attach themselves to the shame and say, oh, you know, it's sort of like shame. It's kind of like if you think about, like, here's this glob of shame, and it's anything that it can use to F with your head will stick to it. So here's shame as like this baseline thing that just kind of gets, it's like it's in us for some weird reason that I have some theories about recently that I'm developing on that. But let's just say it's just a thing. And oh, here's something to be shameful about. You don't look pretty enough, and it sticks to the shame. So it's not like the not looking pretty enough causes the shame. The shame uses it as evidence of its truth. Like, oh, hi, I'm shame, and you're not good enough. Really? Why not? Because of that. Because of that. Because you did this. Because you did that. And then you confuse the things with the reason, the justification, the evidence of the shame. But what I've discovered and is that the shame is there even if there's no evidence.
So it's nonspecific in some ways, or like adaptable to the situation. It's almost Does it have its own consciousness almost, the shame itself?
That is not a position I am willing to express as true. But I will say that it appears to me often mm-hmm. that aspects of consciousness have their mm-hmm. have different agendas mm-hmm. within us and mm-hmm. Conflictual agendas. Like mm-hmm. we are not congruent in our agendas within ourselves. Now, why is that? I don't know.
I'm going to do what you did to me there as far as, can you re-say that slower? Agendas congruent within yourself.
Okay.
Can you, like, what are some words between those spaces?
Okay. Yeah. So, all right. So let's define terms. Good call. So when I say agenda, I mean, what is it that you want? What is it that you as a person want to do? You mm-hmm. want to be happy. You want to be safe. Mm-hmm. Your agenda. And there's a million different ways that you might want to do that. But we have these mm-hmm. agendas within us. Mm-hmm. So, and we have, and different parts of us, we often, as humans, people say, I think this, but then I also think that. Well, how can it be if we're just one state of mind? We're obviously mm-hmm. multiple states of mind. And, mm-hmm. and like, let's say underneath all of that, I want to be happy and safe. And then, so that might be the same agenda for all the different parts of me, mm-hmm. but the methods by which I'm going to try to achieve that might be in conflict. Like I might have one part of me that says, in order to be happy and safe, I need to make all of the unsafe people go away. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a big job.
Ah, what was your book title coming up?
Okay, yeah, that's good. I should probably announce it now in case somebody else steals my book idea. Or should I?
Yeah, do it.
Will this give evidence that this is my damn book?
Yeah, this is documenting it.
It's documenting it. Okay, yeah. So my next book that I'm writing is called Your Intentions Are Good, But Your Methods Are Crap. Dun dun dun. And for those of you who are if you want to read my previous book, this is a good time for me to plug it. The Mature Empath: Stages of Developing Your Psychic and Empathic Gifts, available on Amazon. Anyway, there we go. Okay. So, but yeah, my next book is Your Intentions Are Good, But Your Methods Are Crap.
Do people feel ashamed for those crappy methods?
People will feel ashamed about anything.
Anything. That's right. Going back, because that was where I got off. You had this glob of shame that is almost opportunistic in some ways.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. It is because it, in order for it to, it eats, it makes its own food.
So the agenda could be starving the shame? Could it be mm-hmm. giving it a place to live that's okay? That is sort of like a cave?
I think underneath the shame is, shame is like, maybe if you look at it, shame is like maybe the last, one of the last gatekeepers before recognition that you just are pure light. It's like the big dark glob mm-hmm. in front of the light. It's like my poem. You know, I sent you that poem. That was a poem that was, you know, that showed up in my Facebook memories. Uh-huh. So I did, but I thought, I didn't put it on, I didn't repost it, but I just sent it to you individually. Yeah. But that's about that.
Yeah, that is about that. I have my smartphone with me right now, listening audience.
Oh, we're so optimistic.
I know. You're already awake beneath sleeping. You're already pure light beneath shadows. You already see beneath blindness. You already know beneath not knowing. You already remember beneath forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, beautiful poem.
Thank you.
Already pure light beneath shadows. Another SH word, shame. Because you made this connection between pure light and the shame being a barrier between that. Right. Now, there's a lot of words definitely between shame and pure light. You know, my like spiritual world framework, the pure light stuff is kind of esoteric, you know? I mean, I get it with pure light, but it's outside of a lot of my conception of what might be what happens when shame is overcome.
Do you know why? You know what? And that's such a good point that I forget sometimes. Mm-hmm. See, as an energy worker, I do see those things, yeah. Literally.
Not me.
So I forget. That's such a good point. To you, it seems abstract.
Very.
Okay, that's such a good point. But I want to, let's deconstruct that a little bit, because I think you brought something up that I think would be interesting to explore for a second. So let me see if I can find it. I'll go back to my Joshy communication list over here. Thank you for being such a good friend, by the way.
Well, you're welcome.
Okay, so I'm looking at that poem, and apparently I wrote it according to my Facebook memories. This is one I wrote back in 2018. But okay, so let's look at the things, because I talked about how shame grabs whatever as its own evidence of its truth, and big old air quotes, right? Yeah. You should be ashamed because, and then it also, oh, see, I'm such a good person because I feel ashamed. Boy, doesn't work. Okay, but anyway, but let's look at this. So you're already awake beneath sleeping. Oh, I'm sorry, I was sleeping. People feel shame sometimes about sleeping. Mm-hmm. Beneath blindness. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see that. Oh, I should have seen that. Oh, I didn't see it. Mm-hmm. I feel ashamed. Oh. Oh, I forgot. Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I'm such a bad person because I forgot. Right? So there's this sense of, I just was kind of, I mean, I might be playing that into the hilt, but at the same time, I think it's like the thing that is in the thing that is in the way of light is shame in one way or another. And shame makes its own food. Hmm. It eats shame. It looks for things, evidence of shame. Oh, num, 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 num. Ah, yes. Mm, yummy in my tummy. Hmm. Shame, shame, shame. Mm-hmm. Hmm. I didn't know. Oh, I should have known. See, you already know beneath not knowing. Oh, I should have known. Why didn't I know that? Uh-huh. Or the other side of that is like, oh, I already knew that. If people say, oh, I already knew that, or, oh, yeah, I know,
yeah.
What they're saying is it would be shameful if I didn't.
Ah, okay, good one. I like the way you did that with the vocal intonations. Well done. That was essential.
Okay.
That was essential. In the absence of our YouTube expressiveness, vocal intonations are invaluable.
Hear, hear.
Hear, hear.
Well, okay. All right. So I think that's... that's a lot to stew on. Let's kind of wrap up some of the ideas without trying to add any more. Mm-hmm. And pick it up next time. Because my brain hurts. Does your brain hurt a little bit? Mine's a little ouchy from that. That was good stuff though.
Where I want to go with the next one is how touching relates to shame. Because I'm an embodied person. And I want to bring bodies into this picture of shame, where we actually talk about touching, about contact, about sensuality and shame, not necessarily in terms of intimacy, but as far as how touching removes blockages and how just relational interactions, because your healing process, maybe not always involving touching, but there's a level of proximity that plays into it. So this idea between the connections between bodies being used for resolving the blockages is where I would like to go.
Okay. I want you to say it again and I'm going to write it down.
How the connection between bodies can be used to assist with removing blockages.
Okay. So let me make sure. I don't know if I got this quite right. How the connection between bodies can be used to assist with removing blockages.
Pretty much. We can flesh it out next time, but it has to do with your energy healing work, and it has to do with tango.
Boop, boop, boop. Tango. Boop.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, sweetheart. All right. So, all right. Well, thank you so much for helping this podcast to be more cool and awesome. And I'm really grateful to you for that.
Well, I am grateful to be here with you right now.
Okay. Well, all right. So everybody, thank you so much. And we would absolutely love if you would, like, in the show notes, there's a link for you to leave a message and ask a question or give a advice or I don't know. Come on, my peeps. All right. That was awkward. I feel super awkward now.
Shame?
A little bit.
Get over it, Tracy.
Okay. All right. All right. We'll talk to you guys next time.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so this is the thing when it's making no weird sound. So okay, all right. This is when it's not blinking right now. Not blinking, Josh. And this is, so let's see if it worked.